You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
And you're on board with our Mother's Day special. Wow, what a show today, folks. Gloria Gaither and Ruth Graham, all in the same package. Lots of things to chat about. Also, Hollywood actress Madeline Osborne will be joining us. She co-hosted the show a little while ago, our celebrity co-host, and shared a bit with us about her family and her mom and what it was like facing the reality of her mom dying. Well, since then, Madeline's mom has sadly passed away, and this will be her first Mother's Day without her, so we'll catch up with Madeline Osborne very soon. Gloria Gaither has authored many, many books for adults and children. She has written the lyrics to over 600 songs, including such gospel classics as Because He Lives, The King Is Coming, Something About That Name, Something Beautiful, Upon This Rock. My goodness, the list just goes on and on. These Are They, Let's Just Praise the Lord, I Am a Promise. She has written a dozen musicals, produced videos, and with the Gaither Trio has recorded over 60 albums, folks. Count them, 60. Gloria Gaither. Author, lyricist, teacher, speaker, grandmother. Happy Mother's Day to you, Gloria.
Thank you, Drew.
I guess it's tomorrow, but we'll pretend it's today. Huh? That is quite a list of accolades, and not bad for someone in her 30s.
Well, yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I love to hear bios because it sounds like I actually finished something. The truth is that in most of my life, I feel like I've got stuff that's unfinished lying everywhere around the kitchen counter and on my desk, and you know, yeah. Everything's in process, including planting the rest of my flowers. Is it raining up there?
It is. We're having some rain. Are you getting any?
Yes, it's rain. So I've got geraniums out and half of the impatiens, and the rest are just sitting there.
My wife is a gardening freak, and the amount of money we spend every year on mulch or topsoil or triple mix or, you know, annuals, perennials. Yeah, I'm just learning these words.
Well, you're good.
Yeah,
I'm impressed.
Yeah, well, she will be too if she heard what I just said. So, listen, the first thing I want to just express my condolences for losing such a good friend in Anthony Berger.
Yes, Anthony was with us a long, long time. So it was such a jolt because we've dealt with a lot of loss in the homecoming family. But when you're dealing with people who are older, when we started back in 1990, and just kind of trying to honor some of the people that had spent their lives in gospel music and had, you know, had blazed the trail for younger people, you think that, you know, you might lose some of them in the process, but you don't expect, you know, a very young man to collapse on stage at the piano doing what he does.
No, that was tough. That was tough for everybody. And I had the honor of interviewing Luann a little while ago, and what a tremendous time we had. I think we talked for about 45 minutes, and the interview has gone around the world. We have people from all over the world listening to that interview, and what a tribute she gave to her husband. So quite a loss for all of you.
People, I say, how will you replace him? And you don't ever replace anybody. You just do something else.
Yeah. Well, let's do sort of a chronological thing here, if you don't mind, and take you way back. Well, okay, it's not way back, but
no way.
born Gloria Sickle, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
March 4th, 1942 in Battle Creek, Michigan.
Right.
You were born up here in the cold weather.
I was. I was a Michigan girl until I went away to college, and I'm still a Michigan girl. I mean, you just can't have this much water in your veins and get away from it. I told Bill it would take a call of God on my life to make me move to the flat Indiana cornfields and be landlocked.
Yeah, yeah.
Must have had a call on my life because I've been here for a while.
You miss the Great Lakes, do you?
I do, and the water in between.
Yeah.
In high school, I worked for a real estate agent and sold mostly lake properties in Clare County. What do we have, 2,500 lakes in our county or something?
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I miss it.
Well, 64 years ago, if my math is right, 64 years ago, what kind of a childhood did you have growing up?
I had an incredible childhood. My parents were pastors, and I would have to say I didn't know until I got to college that many kids resent having pastors and missionaries for parents. I always wondered why I didn't feel like that. In fact, I wrote a book after I started thinking about all of that called What My Parents Did Right, because I asked myself, why don't I resent this? And I look back, and I came up with a couple things. One is I don't ever remember my parents telling me to do anything because I was a preacher's kid.
Right. So
they,
no unrealistic expectations
no,
on you.
They just they told pretty major expectations. They said, you mind God.
That'll
if
work.
If you're minding God, we will support you if we have to leave this church to do it.
Really?
And so I never felt like the ministry was something they did that took them away from me, that other people got my parents, but that I didn't get them, but because they involved my sister and me in everything they did. I mean, we prayed for people. I went to the hospital with my dad. I went to more funerals than I can tell you, and more weddings. And ministry was something they did. It wasn't it was something they were, not something they did.
Hmm.
So I grew up, I think the best thing about my childhood is that I grew up with all these amazing people in my house. Around our dinner table, there were theologians and missionaries and preachers, and I'm going to talk about that at the conference that you just mentioned on the air before we came on. And also at our table, I guess in my early eyes, I just wanted to have something important enough to say at our table, and my parents thought that was a good thing.
Hmm.
And then also at our table were pregnant teenagers and people who were recovering alcoholics who shouldn't be by themselves on the weekend, or, you know, people that had addictions or had run away or just didn't have a place to live at the moment. And so ministry was what we did. And the whole family was involved in it. It was part of the sinew of our bones.
So you grew up in a God family, and it was genuine, it was real, it was transparent, and that's great. When did you start to own your own Christianity?
Well, actually, I started owning. I was converted when I was 4, and I can't remember when I didn't want to do God's will for my life. But the turns that has taken. If I had known that ahead of time, I probably would have just said, I don't think so. But I have come to really believe that God's will for your life is the interruptions, and I'm going to talk about that.
Yeah, a favorite author of mine, Mike Iaconelli, talks about the God of the in-betweens.
In between, we live our lives in the meantime.
Yeah, exactly. But this childhood commitment at 4... Was there a wandering, a rebellious, a walk through the wilderness, I'm gonna rebel kind of thing happen?
It didn't happen at all. I had a rebel mother. Maybe that was why. my mother was. I mean, when I was 17, she gave me books on existentialism and said, "You're gonna run into this in college. You better know what they're saying."
Wow, really?
And there was no debate closed at our table. And
good for her.
My parents always encouraged me to think. My dad was more structured, much more traditional, and he would say, I don't know why you need to read all that stuff, just read the Bible. But he was also an incredible Bible scholar, and I probably had as much learning by the time I left home as most people get in seminary. The hard thing has been, though, that all sounds easy. The hard thing has been God's will for this minute.
Right.
And I think the difficulty of life is always choosing between the good, better, and the best, and all the voices that are calling for you. And looking back, I think I'm not sure Christians can have long-term goals. I'm not right on the foot of somebody you just had on that says you got to have goals.
No.
And you got to have, you know, I hear these planners that say, well, where do you want to be 10 years from now, and where do you want to be 5 years from now, and church building goals and church development goals and all this. I'm not sure Christians can have goals except to show up at the throne.
Well, yeah, a good friend of mine named Mel Stevens, who's the founder and director of Teen Ranch just north of here, always says to me, Drew, you need to be an ass for Jesus. And, you know, talking about the donkey that was tied up and simply available. And you can't be available if you're locked into everything in these 20-year goals.
Yeah, you know what? We're all control freaks, especially in this culture in North America. I think we are just control freaks.
Yeah.
And we're told in everything in our culture, don't lose control. You take charge. Don't ever get in a situation where you're left-footed and you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you look out for number one. And I think, Jesus, that is so anti-Christ, that philosophy. And I think that's the tough thing, to fight that in the culture. And if you have abilities and you have strengths, every voice is saying to you, you need to have, you know, you need to decide where you're going, and you got to have a plan for your life, and you got. And I think God is saying, okay, fine, you do it then.
Very well said. Gloria Gaither on the phone with us, and just talking about life on this Mother's Day special. The siblings, did you have many? Was there?
I have one sister, and she's 10 years older, and ironically, we are very, very close. In fact, I'm grieving at the moment because she just moved from being close to me for 23 3 years to Wichita. I don't know why. All her kids and grandkids are there.
At 74, at 74 she moved to Wichita?
She moved to Wichita, and she and her husband and decided that they would build a house near there. Both of their daughters are in ministry in the same church. That's quite unusual, I think. It's a large church, and one of her sons-in-laws is the minister of music, and the other is one of the pastors. And so both her daughters and all five of her grandchildren are in Wichita.
Well,
so she voted for them over me.
Can you believe it? The nerve. The nerve. Unbelievable.
But she's going to love Mother's Day this year.
Oh, yeah, in a big way, yeah. Well, December 22nd, 1962. What's so special about that day?
Well, that's when my what I thought was God's plan for my life took an abrupt turn. I took French and sociology to prepare actually to go to the mission field, and I was in my mind, I thought it might be Kenya, and therefore the French for some of the dialects, African dialects. Instead, I ended up meeting this young man who was teaching English, and I was teaching French, and I was a student. Substituting in French.
Talk about the language of love. That's a good, man.
And he was already through school and had his master's, so we hadn't met in college, although we went to the same college. But we ended up getting married a year later, and during my senior year in college. And by then he had told me that he had written a few songs. He had traveled with his brother and sister, working his way through college and in high school. But they had gone their separate ways, and he was directing a choir at that time. And after we got married, we began to write stuff for the choir. Bill is an incredible sensor of need, and I think I am too. And so we would always come at things idea-wise. There ought to be a song that says that, you know.
Right.
And there wasn't. We have always written to fill vacuums. But I started kind of fixing his lyrics because my background was literature and poetry, and I'd always been a writer, and he loved music more. So I started fixing his lyrics, and it wasn't long before we were collaborating, and I was writing all the lyrics, and he was writing the music mostly. But we were always idea-driven, and we would run them off on the mimeograph, our songs on the mimeograph at school. Now, there are people listening who don't know what a mimeograph is.
Isn't that sad?
But anyway, it's that purple ink stuff that we used to use to print things.
Gloria, there are people that are listening that don't know what an 8-track is.
That's right, or a record. I mean, those great big CDs. But we would give it to the choir, and then if they like it, we told them we wrote it. If they didn't, we just kept our mouth shut.
Yeah, said some Canadian wrote it or something.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, the collaboration started back then and has continued on for many years now. I want to know how we proposed. Was it a classy proposal, or was it like a dinner and a movie and say, so
no,
you want
to? No, none of the above. He pulled up in front of the dorm to let me off, to go back into the dorm one night, and said, I think Christmas break would be a good time to get married, don't you?
Really?
And I said, are you talking about anybody specifically or just in general?
Bill Gaither, come on.
However, and then after that, I went home for the summer to work my way through college at Kellogg's, flicking the burnt cornflakes off the conveyor belt at Kellogg's. And he would come up on weekends to see me, and one weekend that summer when he came up, he brought me a diamond.
So you went from one flake to another?
Yep.
Oh, man.
That's just it. So it was sort of this feels like the right thing. When are we going to do it?
Okay, 43 years has it been?
43 years.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when they hear 43 years, go, wow, how did you do it? You know, in a day and age when one in two marriages are in the toilet, how did you do it?
I don't know. I wish I had some big wisdom for you.
Because you're both, from what I understand, you're both fairly high drivers.
We're pretty opinionated, and fortunately or unfortunately, all three of our children are in the arts. So
that
one on.
Oh, man.
We prayed they'd be nuclear physicists or something.
Yeah, something.
That side of their brain was missing, I think. But Suzanne's a writer and writes many of the things for the vocal band, and Amy is an actress. She teaches theater at DePaul, and Benji is in animation and songwriter and, you know, loves movies and is in film. In fact, he was just in the movie Hoodwinked.
Was he?
He was the mountain goat that is so hyper he keeps singing when he can't say any lines. He has to sing them all. I said, oh, well, that sounds like the story of my life. Oh. I've been hearing him come a long time.
So the three kids, the 43 years of marriage, highs and lows. I mean, let's talk about the struggles, the tough stuff.
Well, I think the tough thing is, it was both the good and the bad of our marriage has been. Most people, I think, get up in the morning and one goes to work and the other, or they both go to work, or one goes to work and one stays home, or, you know, they do things separately and then they come back together and, you know, yeah. all that. And I think the hard part of that life is that you tend, especially I think husbands, tend to share more important things with their secretaries than they do their wives. Because they don't, you are not in the major process of life with your chief partner.
Why do we do that as males? Is
that it? I
don't
know. Well, I think it's American thing and a Canadian thing. It's you know, this is, again, you got to have a plan. You got to go, and even if you forfeit everything to do it, that pressure to succeed, to do it. But it's doable if you come home and talk.
Yeah.
But as somebody said, men only say, well, how many... 20,000 or 2,000 words in a day, and women say 20,000, and when men get home, they've said them all already.
Yeah.
So they, I don't know if that's true. But I do think you tend to grow in different directions, and that, I think, is very hard. Our situation was exactly the opposite, and that is not easy either. And that is...
Growing together, working together, everything together.
Everything together.
Yeah.
We got up together. We had babies together. We, you know... stayed home together, we wrote songs together, we traveled on the road together, we juggled kids and, you know, carried bags through airports and came home together. But in that, we did grow together and in the same directions, and we were having the same experiences coming home and saying, there ought to be a song that fit that, and there wasn't. Or
yeah.
The bad thing is, you also have to fight in public or else not fight at all. And people, many interviews over the years have said, do you ever fight? Bill always says you could sell tickets. But the real answer, I mean, that's a joke, but the real answer is not nearly enough.
You don't fight nearly enough?
We don't fight nearly enough.
What does that mean?
When do you do it? When do you resolve conflict?
Right.
And how?
Yeah.
If you're on stage, you don't. If you're on the bus with other people, you tend to not. If you come home after a hard weekend and you've got the day Sunday with your kids and your in-laws or whoever, just, you know, to do family things, are you going to take that day? And then by Monday, then you're off again to the office and publishing. And when do you do it?
So isn't that scary with the buildup? We're not supposed to let things build up like that.
Exactly. And I think that is the thing. And then who brings it up? And, you know, and
remember 6 months ago when you did this?
Right. And it tends, that's the other thing. You tend to not resolve conflicts on a more daily basis so that it builds up and usually explodes over something that is not the issue. And I would say this to most couples, trust me, what you're fighting over is not the issue.
No, exactly.
It's always the toothpaste or the car wasn't filled up with gas or some stupid thing. But the real issue is, I don't feel loved. I don't feel respected.
Appreciated, needed.
You walked over the line.
Yeah.
You know, I think men tend to say, you don't respect me, you don't trust my judgment, and women tend to say, you don't love me, you're not tender.
You're not listening.
You aren't sensitive,
yeah.
You aren't listening,
yeah.
You aren't present. So, you know, that's the big stuff, but it usually comes up over something small, and I just honestly think there should be some system of talking, and I really ache for people who don't get home, especially in our culture, to 5 or 6, sometimes later than that at night.
Oh, yeah.
They're exhausted. They are not in a frame of mind to deal with anything, not even the children. But usually, I talked to a man this last week, lovely Christian man. Both of them are college educated. She teaches at a university. He's in another business. And he said, we don't have a life.
Hmm.
And I don't know if this is ringing a bell with anybody out there, but he said, when we both get home, we're exhausted. And we try to spend time with the children, some kind of quality time before bedtime with the kids. And they're trying to remodel their house and live in it. So he said, we work on the house a little while. And we fall into bed, and we get up the next morning and do the same thing.
Do it all over again. Well, but I mean, in your life, Gloria, though, I mean, seriously, you are one of the busiest women on the face of the planet. And I really think that in order to be successful in work, that you've got to sacrifice something else because there's only so many hours in the day. And family is usually what gets taken for granted. So, and these days, you have an enormous workload. Please tell me that you didn't work that much when the kids were younger.
Well, I worked harder probably, but I also did the carpooling and went to all the games and all the theater productions and all the writing awards and all the, and Benji had a rock and roll band from the time he was 14. So all, a whole battery of teenagers lived at our house night and day. And Bill would say, do we never have any privacy? And I say, if we do this right, we will one day.
Yeah.
But
have you
but,
hit that now?
Yeah, we do. And the great thing is, I think when the kids get to the place where they're your peers and sometimes your advisors,
yeah,
that's really great. I had my two grandsons last night. We spent the night, great big lunkin' kids. One's 11, one's 13, but they're huge. Great big, they look like teenagers.
Is this Will and Jesse?
Yep, and we went down to the Highway Cafe for breakfast. And but family has always, as you know, been a priority for us. And the rest of the stuff, if it gets shoved in there, fine. And when we were on the road on weekends, number one, we made a decision early on that we would not be gone during the week.
Well, that segues nicely into my next question. And folks, I'll just remind our listeners, we're on the phone with Gloria Gaither. What sort of boundaries, healthy boundaries, have you instilled in this circus that you sometimes live?
Well, Bill has been fabulous about that from day one. I mean, he is religious. When our children were little, he just religiously turned down anything that was during the week. We traveled on weekends. We tried to take one child, the child that needed it the most. Our three children, as it turned out, we weren't smart enough to plan this. So don't let this sound virtuous.
Right.
But it was just survival. But my mother and dad moved here from the ministry. My dad had a coronary, and so they moved here. And the doctor said if you get out of the ministry, you could probably live a while. So they came down here and took care of our children, or I would not have traveled. And I tried to take one of the children, the one that needed it the most, whether, you know, it was a little one that just needed to be cuddled or whether it was one of the bigger ones that needed to talk as time went on. Hmm. But we took one kid, so that kid was special for the weekend on the bus. And they grew up with, you know, Steve Green and Sandy Patty and, you know, all the people that traveled with us.
Sure.
But then they also had their normal life. We live in a little farm community of 6,000. They went to public school. I'm not a big homeschool advocate because, honestly, you know, I wanted our children to experience what they were going to have to deal with in the world while I had them.
Well, plus, I would imagine your children would be hanging around a lot of adults.
They did. And
so they need to hang around the peers, the kids a lot, right?
And the other thing is, I think Christian parents need to be involved in the school system, and I don't think there's any big bad day keeping us out.
Yeah, good for you.
I think, I mean, both Bill and I were public school teachers, and I never knew a teacher in my whole life who wasn't tickled to death if a parent showed up for anything.
Right.
So I don't think that you need to be uninvolved in the public school system.
No.
And
Christians do enough run away as it is.
Run away and cocoon. And I think a formula for disaster is to cocoon your children while they're little and then send them to a secular university.
Yeah.
Where they're not prepared. They haven't interfaced with the world. A lot of those kids, those public school kids, practically lived at our house. And they come back now to see us when they come home from college or from their married lives. And they say, this is where I grew up.
Gloria, in regards to discipline, did you spank? Were you a spanker?
It depends on the kid.
Right.
I don't think you can make hard and fast rules. I think there are children, and two of our children were very strong-willed. The other one was compliant.
Right.
And I think for strong-willed children, you have to draw boundaries or they freak out. And I think a lot of the ADD we're seeing is because there are no boundaries, and it leaves children at loose ends.
Yeah.
Most of the time, I felt like if I did have to spank, I had failed. I mean, not that the spanking was a failure, but that I had done something not quite wise enough before it got that far.
Right.
And I, at that point, then I had to spank. But I don't think you teach children to be nonviolent by using violence usually, and I don't think spanking should ever, ever be violent, or it should never be angry.
No.
If you're angry, I think you have to wait till you're not angry.
Of your three children, Suzanne, Amy, and Benjamin,
mm-hmm.
Which one of your children are you the most like?
Well, that's interesting because I think all three of them have qualities of both of us.
But is there one you kind of...
I don't know. That would be really hard to say. There are some things like Suzanne and I are really on the same wavelength as writers. She loves literature. She loves learning. And we got our master's together in English.
Really?
I waited until she got through college to finish my master's.
Huh.
And we did our master's together at Ball State. And, I mean, that was just great because our class nights, we ate together. We got to discuss, you know, Steinbeck or Faulkner or whoever we were reading together.
How cool is that?
Shakespeare together, and I love that. Amy is in theater, and she is just a natural communicator. She loves people. Bill used to say, let's don't take Amy on vacation. I don't want any more people on my Christmas card list. But she just is a lover of people, and she and I speak together quite often. We do women's retreats, and sometimes she kind of speaks and sings both, and or she'll do the music and I'll speak, or we'll both speak, or we'll speak together. She's a communicator, and I think I'm a communicator. Suzanne's much more shy. She is an incredible idea person, but her idea of fun is not to walk into a room full of people she doesn't know.
Really?
So that's a different, but our literary connection, and then Benji is just totally visceral, very high energy, high physical. He's more like Bill. He has two speeds, full blast and off. So he's either asleep or he's turning the world upside down.
Did you marry your dad?
No.
You know that phrase that gets thrown around all the time? Because you said your dad was fairly structured and fair, you know, that kind of...
No, I did not marry my dad.
Because I don't know Bill that well, but he comes across... Like you said that your son, Benji, you know, is just a real go-getter and two speeds, you know, high energy or and off or go or stop. And I've always seen Bill as kind of laid back and casual.
No, well, don't let that fool you. No, he's not. He's anything but laid back and casual.
Right.
Although he loves regular life. And that's what one of the things I love about him. We're both high energy when it comes to being with people and communicating. But when we get home, I mean, he loves trees. He loves our yard. He loves walking around and just enjoying the day. He loves sitting up on the deck and having tea at night. And he really is a person who notices life. And all the kids have grown up like that, I think. Benji has always had a passion for music. He had music in him before he talked. I have tapes of him making all these band noises in his mouth when he was 2 and 3 years old. And I cracked up when I saw him in that cartoon movie because it sounded just like the sounds I've heard him make all his life.
Oh man, now he's making money off those things.
Yeah, now I said now you're hopefully you'll make some money out of things that you got spanked for in school.
Yeah.
But he's very funny, and both he and Bill, I think, if they did not stay energized and around people, would be inclined to suffer from some depression.
Right.
Only because I think when you're that sensitive, you tend to feel all the vibes of everybody.
Yeah, makes total sense.
So Bill has treated himself by making a party for the whole world, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're on the phone with Gloria Gaither. A tremendous time. I so much appreciate this. One question I want to ask you, because you're at the risk of making you sound like an old woman here, you have a sort of a matriarchal quality about you, especially within Christendom, well, North American Christendom especially. And these days there seems to be a lot said about how Christians are reacting to the gay and lesbian community. And I know you work with a lot of professional artists and musicians, mm-hmm. and you know, there seems to be a higher proportion of gays and lesbians in the arts. What if one of your children came to you and said, I'm gay? How would you react?
Well, knowing my children, I really haven't on that personal level, but I think that I don't think pulling that one particular thing out from other things your kids might come to you and say, like, for instance, I'm pregnant.
Right.
Or I'm leaving home and going to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
I think it's always important, no matter what situation, the person relationship supersedes everything. It is the only thing eternal.
And I've taken a lot of calls. I've done a lot of talk back. We've had a lot of callers, and there's been a massive response by people saying, as a matter of fact, I had one parent, one guy said to me, I'd rather my kid tell me that they killed someone than that they come home and say that they're gay.
Oh, I hope he doesn't mean that. I'm just not even going to go there.
But you know what I mean? I know, and that's ludicrous, right?
Yeah.
But there seems to be this oh my goodness, especially with Christian parents, oh my goodness, I hope my child never comes home and says that. You know, I'm not even going to talk about it, not even going to think about it. They put their thumbs in their ears and go la, 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 la.
Well, I'll have to go back to relationship is everything, and it is the only thing that will survive this world is relationship. So the relationship has to be salvaged. The lines of communication have to stay open. I think you have to, no matter what your kid comes home and says, this I'm dealing with, this or that or something else, I think you have to go to the Word. I think you have to take it in prayer. And you have to save the relationship. So, you know, some of those things will be very difficult to work out. And there are a lot of issues that are difficult, not just that one. Like, for instance, I'm getting a divorce. Or I have been abused. I mean, there are lots of bombs your child can lay in the middle of the front room for.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Ruth Graham in a little bit on the show, and she's had a lot of those bombs dropped in her lap.
Well, and I speak every weekend to women, and I estimated 1 in 4 have been sexually molested at some time in their life, and they're trying to survive as adult wives and mothers, many of whom have never said that out loud to anybody. And many of them have tried to say it out loud to their own parents, and they said, don't ever speak of this again. That's how they approached it.
Wow.
And so I asked Tony Campolo, you know, are my statistics crazy? I'm sensing like a fourth of the audience, and he said, you're low.
Really?
So when you look at a group of women who look pulled together and perfectly, you know, fine, know that a fourth of them are dealing with a violation at such a deep place that it literally splits your personality unless there is a God thing going on in your life. So, I mean, to pull out that one thing, I just have to say, you have to save the relationship.
I appreciate that answer so much. That's probably one of the best answers I've ever heard. Good for you. I read somewhere that you have struggled with insecurities.
I invented them.
You invented them? Okay.
Well, in some areas, I think, aren't we all confident in some areas and, you know, totally not confident in other areas? As a communicator, I mean, I did speech contests and wrote speeches in high school. I mean, I grew up in a preacher's home where I, you know, I taught Sunday school when I was 12. But musically, I mean, I did what every kid does. You know, you sing the alto when somebody doesn't show up and you play in 6 flats for prayer meeting. But for Bill to come home one day, which he did, and say, this isn't working, you need to sing with me. I'm used to a family group, and I need you to do this. And I said, I don't feel confident in that. Well, actually, I said, I can't sing. And he said, I know you can't. But he said, something happens when you communicate with people. We'll work around the singing. I mean, I didn't have a good range. I mean, I'm a low alto, like a men's tenor range, what range I have, which isn't much.
Right.
And I love music, and I've done that. I've done music all my life in church. But, you know, I just said, okay, you know, everybody's going to watch me fail. You know, doesn't God let me do something I'm good at? But, you know, I've decided that he seldom lets us do what we're good at because, number one, we don't know what we're good at until we get shoved out of our comfort zone. And I think God sees to it that we're out of our comfort zone because when we're in it, we tend to do it without him. So, honestly, my story has taught me an awful lot about God, and that is, I discovered a scripture, Drew, that saved my life when I was about 30. I'd heard it all my life, but I discovered it for me. And it goes like this in, I think, Living Bible says, God's power shows up best in weak people. So I will brag about my infirmities, knowing that if God can do this in me, think what he could do in you.
Gloria, are you one of those people who have been blessed with this gift of faith and never really seems to doubt or overthink things?
In fact, I am suspicious of people who never doubt. I think their faith is about a dime short. You know, I think they're gullible instead of full of faith usually. that's a judgmental and ugly thing to say. Okay, I'll take that back.
No, but I get it. I totally understand that.
I think, you know, if you don't, if there isn't some crucible of if your mind isn't working, then what good is your faith?
Yeah.
And there is a difference, I think, between virtue and innocence. A big difference. Adam and Eve in the garden were virtuous. They had never come across any evil. But when evil happens to you, and it will happen to every person, the Garden of Eden happens with every person. Sorry. I think when you choose to do right, not because you don't know any better, but because you've struggled with it, then it becomes virtue. You know, I'm a doubter. I'll just admit it.
But I think there are those people around who have maybe been actually blessed with the spiritual gift of faith. Not just, you know, we all have faith, which waxes and wanes, but there's those few and rare people that have this spiritual gift of faith, and they just don't ever seem to slip into those doubting phases.
Well, first of all, I think faith is always a gift. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's something you just say, I just gotta, you know, concentrate and work up more faith. I need more faith. Well, if I didn't have faith, then I wouldn't be sick, or if I had more faith.
Right.
And I think, you know what? You don't get faith. God gives you faith. Faith is a gift. And for many of us, faith comes through a process, a crucible. It is a refining fire that produces faith. And often, most often, faith comes through some kind of pain.
Yeah, that's right.
Pain is, I love what C.S. Lewis said, pain is God's megaphone.
To a deaf world.
And so, and to us. And I think pain is what crowds us to Christ.
Right.
So almost all, I think all great people of faith, all the great saints I've known have never just woken up some morning and gotten faith. So I don't know. I think there are people who struggle less than other people with belief. I guess I come across too many people who don't fit the mold.
But are you an over-analytical kind of overthinker?
I'm an overthinker. I'm not an. I don't think I would consider myself. Oh, I don't know. I guess you'd have to have a personality test for that. I don't think that I believe that you reason yourself to God.
Right.
I think if a God you can reason yourself to probably isn't God. But I do believe that I can't stop my mind. Let me say that. I can't stop my mind.
So when your head hits the pillow, how long does it take you to fall asleep?
It doesn't take me very long. It's when I wake up that my mind drives me crazy.
Really?
I'm a morning person, and I wake up asking questions.
Really? That's interesting. Is it true that Gloria Gaither is a compulsive journal writer?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I'm not one of those that write in it every day. I write when I feel like it. But, yeah, I've kept a journal for years. And here's why. I think it gives you perspective. The things you tend to think are just either incredibly good, oh, this is the greatest thing since ice cream, or incredibly bad, I can't live through this, probably are neither one as big a deal as you think.
Yeah.
And many of the things that you find you will barely write down in your journal, little tiny moments with people, a little passing remark, a little moment with a kid, a little night of making love, a little something, when you read back over it, you'll say, oh, my word, the whole door of my life swung on that hinge. And so I think it makes you treasure the little things. I think it makes you get the big stuff into perspective. And I love Kipling's poem where he says, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you and make allowance for their doubting too, if you can make of the unforgiving moment 60 seconds worth of distance run. I mean, I just love that whole poem, If, and everybody's seen it on graduation cards. But it's so true. You've got to get things in perspective. And I think most of the time things aren't as good as you think you are, and most of the time you're not as bad as you think you are either.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, look, in sort of wrapping all this up, I want to talk about the worship scene today. It seems to have exploded in that even the youngies are right into worship, the young crowd, and everybody seems to have a worship CD. And, you know, I mean, it was 20 years ago. That was not the case, I don't think. And yet, within North American Christianity, I need your help in this. Okay, I'm asking you for some advice personally. I don't really care if anyone's listening to the show right now. Can you give me some advice so that I don't become a cynical jerk? I'm talking about the marketing of it, the selling of worship, the marketing of worship, the business of worship.
Well, this is a whole speech, and maybe we should do a whole another program on that sometime. But let me do it as quickly as I can.
Sure, thanks.
Historically and biblically, I can't find any example where worship is not praise, what is not a result and not a cause. We have made it a cause. We walk in off the streets on Sunday morning after we fish the kids' shoestrings out of the commode, and we roll our eyes back and put our hands in the air, and we get a worship band, and we start worshiping. It doesn't work like that. Never has, never will. That will leave you empty and cold. It will be, I mean, we'll try to feel it, we'll try to get it working, and maybe we'll do that by remembering in our mind sometime when worship was real. But God doesn't come when we blow a whistle.
Right.
Worship is a result of our personal lives interfacing with one of the major cardinal truths. By that I mean things they write theology books about, like forgiveness, healing, giving your control freak personality to the Lordship of Christ, reconciliation, repairing a broken relationship, saying I'm sorry, restitution. When those things happen to you personally, the result will be praise, and you can't stop it. Neither can you cause it. It has to be a result. It's always been a result. All through Scripture, it was a result. It comes then after you're a veteran, after you've had a lot of work of God in your life, it comes from recounting your history with God. Like, for instance, I was saved a long time ago, but God saves me from myself every day. And I believe that because I look back and see the altars I have built through the wilderness. And I can say to Satan, God met me there and there and there. So I have a history with God. I'm not as much of a pushover to Satan as I once was, because I have a history with God. And one of the things in corporate worship, when we come together, is we have got to recount our history with God. But I think what you are talking about, what you are experiencing, and what we call the praise and worship craze, is what is also going on in the culture. We want instant everything.
Right.
We all want the product without the process. We want the climax without the commitment. And if we go there, and I'm going to use this sexual example, and you'll probably get letters.
Oh, I hope I do. I love letters.
But if we go to the climax without a commitment,
yeah,
it will cheapen the commitment. There won't be a commitment ever.
Right, right.
You can't just do that. You can't just go for the result. You can't just go for the punchline.
Right.
Now, let me do this as a songwriter. I am in rooms all the time where people are going through gleaning the Psalms, because that's cool right now, to get one wonderful positive psalm and write this repetitious chorus around it. So, you know, they go through the Psalms, zooming, fast-forwarding. Isn't it that a product of our culture, fast-forwarding past all the lament, all the doubt, all the screaming at God, all the depression, all the, where are you, God? I'm being defeated by my enemies. I don't know if I even believe in you. We go right past all that to a good, positive line. God, you came through. You were faithful. You are awesome, and I believe you. Okay. I was in a room full of songwriters. I asked those 200 songwriters. Mark Lauer and I did a workshop. And I said, I want to know who's here. How many of you songwriters have read 1st and 2nd Samuel in the last, say, 3 years? Two out of 200. And I'm saying, okay, what right have you to be plagiarizing David's punchlines when you don't even know his story?
Yeah, when you don't get the guts of it.
You don't know what he paid for that line. What right have you to use his line when you didn't know? You don't even know what he paid for it. And I really believe that that is what's happening. We aren't even telling each other our punchlines. I mean, our stories. We're just using punchlines. We're walking in. It's like that old story about telling jokes, and they told the joke so many times from the joke book that they just walked in and said, you know, number 56, and everybody cracked up laughing.
Yeah, right.
And that's kind of what we're doing.
Right.
But it has to be. Praise is a wonderful thing. Praise is necessary. Praise will result if something is happening in your church. And if something is truly happening in the lives of believers and they are community together, they are really know each other, they are really in prayer over each other's kids, they are in agony over each other's pain, they are taking each other home when they're a single mom, they're taking her kids to the zoo, and they know what's going on in that kid's life, okay, then we're going to experience praise together. But to just walk in and not know each other and start saying the punchlines of praise,
Got it. I'm going to have to listen to that again, because you dropped some major morsels in what you just said there. You just said it's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. I mean, 60 years of following Christ and having written lyrics to over 600 songs, I think you have the merit to be able to say what you did. So thank you.
I love praise, and we need praise and worship, but it's got to come from the wonderful things God is continuing to do in our daily life.
What's around the corner for Gloria Gaither?
Oh, well, for right in front of my face is a summer, hopefully with the grandkids, and we're just about through our season. We quit in June 1st, and we have always been off in the summer with our kids.
Spend time in the sandbox.
So, yep, I'll be planting the rest of my flowers.
Yeah. Looking forward to having you come up this way. I'd love to meet you one of these days and shake your hand.
Come over. I'll put an apron on. They won't know the difference.
That'll work. Gloria, thank you very, very much for sharing some of your heart with us on this Mother's Day special.
Thank you, Drew. I'm missing my mom. We buried her on Mother's Day about 10 years ago.
Oh, did you?
So I really, really miss her on this day.
Yeah, it is a tough thing, and myself as well. My mom died when I was 22. She died the same night my son was born, and that was a tough, tough thing to go through. So I empathize so much with people who are missing their moms today. When I think of you today, Gloria, I'll pray for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your heart.
Bless you.
All the best.
Bye.
Gloria Gaither on the Drew Marshall Show. What a neat lady she is. Well, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, it's time to get you folks to call in and brag about your mom. We do this every year. Just give you an opportunity to phone in. Get your mom to listen wherever she's at. Get her to turn the radio to 1250. Surprise her by calling in. Look, no matter what kind of relationship you have with your mom these days, I want you to stop what you're doing and at least give your mom a call today and tell her how much you appreciate her. Will you do that for me? Because, again, like I just said, I don't have a mom to talk to anymore, and I waited till it was too late to say the important things to my mom. So don't wait for Mother's Day to get here tomorrow. Give her a call today. We would love for you to phone in 905-338-1250. We'll go for about 30 minutes bragging on your mom on the Drew Marshall Show when we come back.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.